You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and we've got about 7 more episodes from the Edinburgh shows from last festival to bang out. But we're going to take a brief break from them now in order to sneak this one out that we recorded last Sunday at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival. I've been trying to get Nick Helm on the show for ages. We've never managed to work the dates out, and we finally sorted it, so I'm really pleased with this. I think we started to get to the bottom of what he's all about, and I think Nick is fascinatingly... Oh, no, I just remembered that's the drinking game, isn't it? Whenever Stu says fascinating or refers to being a busker, then take a drink. There's probably others as well. Let's chuck some suggestions in on Twitter, please. That was started by @Wateracre, a dear friend of mine, and by all means, rip the piss out of me and all the things I usually do. That could actually be helpful. Anytime Stu is crippled with self-doubt, drink. Anyway, the point being, I think what's really good about Nick, other than his obvious brilliant talent and how funny he is he has a very different take on the purpose of his comedy. And it reminds me a little bit of Tom Parry from Pappy's, from some of the stuff Tom said in that Pappy's interview. So you might want to listen back at that and see if it links. I'm all of a lather, I'm a fluster, I'm leaving, I've got to go to France and do some gigs. Sorry, it's so hard being international jet setter. Yeah, France. So, nonetheless, live at Firebug for Bottle Rocket Comedy as part of the Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival, this is the amazing Nick Helm. I wish I'd thought to smoothly push the chair forward with my foot and then step from the chair onto the stage. I feel quite the prick.
I'm nothing if not smooth.
Do you know what? The sound man, Russell, saw the show that you just done in here.
He went livid.
He checked. He's not going to drop the mic again, is he? And I went, no, he's not. Anyway, thanks for coming.
Russell.
Yeah.
The sound man, Russell.
Russ?
What? This is an ironic name, isn't it?
It's Russ, isn't it?
I mean, I said it's fine that we don't make jokes, but his name is Russell the Soundman.
Oh, sorry.
It's like being a boom operator called Mike or something. Carry on.
I will. So, thanks for coming. I always get really edgy before. I haven't done one of these since Edinburgh, and you were going to come on the show in Edinburgh. And you weren't able to because you were on at the same time.
Your show sort of like clashed with the last 5 minutes of
Yeah, something like that, because I saw your show last time and had to leave 5 minutes before the end to run out here.
That's right.
And I experienced what it was like to be one of the people that you scream abuse at as they're running out of your show on arguably legitimate grounds.
It's always legitimate. I always shout at people legitimately, I feel. I think I do, yeah.
Okay, listen, before we get stuck in, let's Because there'll be people listening. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with you, and a lot of people have seen your act.
There'll be people that don't know who the fuck I am.
For people who don't know who the fuck you are, can you describe what it is you... I was going to say what you think you do. What do you think you do, Nick?
Oh. Oh, maybe I was the worst person to have on your show.
That's all right.
I don't know. I try not to stop and think about it. Otherwise, it undoes like a jumper.
Okay. Well, for the next hour, you're going to have to stop and think about it.
Right, yeah, okay, yeah. Right, it's dawning on me what I've got to do now. I don't know, really. I kind of try... Basically, what I do now is a culmination of lots of failed gigs.
Okay.
So to describe what I do, I kind of... At the moment, I'm doing a lot of shouting and swearing. But, I mean, what I attempt to do is I try and do a bit of everything in one show. I'm trying to do, like, a variety show.
Okay.
That's what my comedy is a stab at, trying to do pretty much everything that you can do on a stage.
Sure. But it's not just about... I'm just trying to see it from the perspective of someone who hasn't seen you, and obviously there's loads of stuff available on YouTube, so there's no excuse for not... seeing you, but for someone listening to this that hasn't seen it, like, for example, I read a review recently that described you as, I think it said something like, a heart on his sleeve romantic having a nervous breakdown on stage.
Yeah, perfect. that's what I do. That's what it is. No, but that is what it is. It's always easier to look at something and describe it than it is to do it from the inside, you know? I mean, you try really hard to do something new and original, and then Turner and Hooch has just come out and you've made Canine, you know, so... Yeah. So you go, oh, yeah, that's what I was making, Turner and Hooch. So, you know, it's always easier to kind of look at what other people do and describe that than it is to kind of...
But you are aware. You're aware of what you're doing. You know, you're aware of what you... Like, I think of your show... as it's something that, like, you've built, and I say show as well because I think of you more in the frame of doing an hour than I do of doing fives or tens or twenties.
I guess
you write shows that are complete.
I guess I'm on the back foot here, just going what I do, because the majority of the people in here have just seen me struggle for an hour.
Yeah. Oh no, and also, I mean, that's quite interesting. A lot of these people have seen the show you, which is very different to you now.
Yeah,
and so it might be difficult for you to just sort of step away from the fact that they've just seen the you that you portray on stage.
Yeah, basically, I mean, I find previewing very difficult, so whatever I do in the previews, it's always kind of like, it'd be really nice to preview what my final idea for a show is, which would be to have a huge set and music and bells and whistles and poems and stuff like that, but it takes a long time to write a poem, let alone three poems, five songs, 8 one-liners and 30 minutes of stand-up comedy. And to do all of that simultaneously, plus design, costumes, set.
And when we say costumes and set, for people that haven't seen it, last year the focus was Evel Knievel.
Yeah, so I had a huge Evel Knievel set and costumes and, like, tearaway costumes and stuff like that. So it's like plate spinning because you've got to develop everything simultaneously. And so previewing is very difficult because not only are you not ever able to preview the show until you get up to Edinburgh, it's just falls so far away from your own expectations of what you're doing that you've literally just got to put on a brave face and kind of, like, you know, pretend to people that this is this is all intentional. But isn't that
something that you do, even when the show is there with everything in it and all the bells and whistles and the costume changes and the exercise bike and the motorbike or whatever, the stunts, even then the show is kind of about you failing to do a show?
Yeah, that's all it is, really. It's kind of like me kind of like trying to put a brave face. Okay, so when I first had to do my first 5 minutes, I think the first time I ever did stand-up comedy, I tried to approach it, or in the back of my head I had it as though, I'm going to do 5 minutes, I'm going to do the best show that I've ever done, it's going to be the best show that anyone's ever seen, and then 2 minutes before I go on stage I've got dumped, and then I have to go through with it, and do it with a... Thanks, mate.
So just to clarify, that's what actually happened, or that's the premise for it?
That's the premise for what, for what it is. And so that when you go on to do 20 minutes, you know, you can have a bit more fun with it and play around with different levels and stuff. And then when you do an hour, well, I mean, I've done like 5 hours now. So when you do an hour, that's kind of like, well, what could it be this time? And I think the first time I did it, I was kind of on the verge of a nervous breakdown. The second time I did it, I was kind of... I think if you put all of my shows end to end, then they kind of tell kind of like a story. Like the character or whatever I do on stage, it's not really a character because it's like an exaggerated part of me. That kind of evolves through each show. So I think with... I did a show called Bad Things Happen in Trees, and that was all about heartbreak, and Keep Hold of the Gold was all about putting a positive spin on things, and then Dare to Dream was about moving on, and This Means War was about being in denial and being bitter about, you know, brokenheartedness, and One Man Megamyth was all about literally going, I'm fine, you know, I'm totally fine now, but it was literally, that was... that was the most nervous breakdown sort of performance that I'd done, because that was all about success and failure.
Yes. So, and that, for people that didn't see it, the beginning of that show was a screen, like the pre-show almost, was a screen that was showing the different years that you'd come to Edinburgh and how cruelly you'd been overlooked for the main awards.
Well, yeah. but the thing is, you know, people think that...
And I should say, just again, for people that haven't seen it, that was really funny. Like, all of those things are getting laughs. It's not, you know, there is you kind of complaining, but it's...
Well, no, I was a bit pissed off about the fact that people were laughing at that, really. no, it's just, I think what people... I don't tend to read press and I don't tend to read journalism, but some things get back to you and stuff like that. And people... just don't seem to realise, you know, what they say kind of affects you. And in a good way as much as a bad way. But somebody said in one of their reviews, he's done some telly and he's done this. What's Nick Helm going to moan about now that he's all successful? Surely that's the end of his act. Because my whole act was being an underdog. And so I wrote One Man Megamyth as a way to kind of like answer that question, which is, even though... I'm Evel Knievel. I'm the most successful person and the most beloved comedian of mine or any generation. I'm still deep down flawed and human, and that's what... and if you don't agree with me, you're a cunt. But that was kind of what the starting point was, is kind of like all of my shows are sort of autobiographical without being necessarily autobiographical, and I've gigged with a lot of people, and you see success change people in ways, and I wanted to kind of like illustrate all of like the downside and the negativity towards success. And One Man Megamyth, basically the story of Evel Knievel is that there was a guy that would literally go out and he would risk his life every single night to entertain people, much like how I risk my health and my well-being just for you pathetic idiots. and so I was kind of like drawing like a really arrogant parallel between me and Evel Knievel. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Evel Knievel wasn't a very nice person, and he cheated on his family, and he had all of these horrifically negative things to him as well. And that was kind of like, I was using him as kind of like an example of what fame was. It's difficult to describe it because a lot of people haven't seen that show, clearly. But but it was nominated, and you got no excuse. I did it twice in London. I did it 26 nights in Edinburgh. You know, what more do you want? I'm doing it one last time in Wales. You can get tickets for it. It's top-notch entertainment.
So when we talk about the... when we talk about the autobiographical, like, is what? How much is there a parallel of autobiographical of what's going on in your life that you're responding to by writing? Like you say, you know, you see people around you get famous, and maybe that helps, or you know, or the arguably the criticism that what can you complain about now because now you're more successful, when that's levelled at you, to what extent did the journey that you've described through those shows reflect... to what extent did the that journey reflect what was going on in your life? Because you, like, everything... All of your shows that I've seen contain an element of heartbreak, of sadness, of torture, of upset, of maybe of depression, as well as all the high bits. You, your shows almost follow, like, they start really excitedly and upbeat and screaming, and then something massive happens, and then you have to recover from it, and you're kind of, you're collapsed and coming back from it. You know, you're sort of shriven during the show. So what I'm asking is, yeah, shriven.
Shriven. I mean, wow.
So what? But what I'm asking is, to what extent do those things reflect actual stuff that's going on in your real life?
Right. Yeah. So have we actually summed up to the listeners what I do? Sometimes I shout and sometimes I swear. And
sometimes you shout and you scream and you do poems and you do songs and it all falls apart and you take your clothes off.
What? Yeah. 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 Basically. What I like to do is I like to show people... I like to show my audiences... Some people like to make it look effortless, but I like my audiences to see where the money's gone. you know, and I sweat a lot, and this year I got on an exercise machine and I'd sung a song while I was... working out and you know I like and I think what's happened to what I do on stage has kind of evolved and that's not necessarily in a good way, not necessarily a bad way, but it's slightly changed from how it started out. And I think what happened originally in 2009 basically not that I don't take responsibility for my career, but I've said yes to a lot of things that I might not have been ready for. And in 2009, I was meant to do a three-hander with two other comedians, and they dropped out at the last minute. So I tried to... It was at the Free Fringe with PBH, and I tried to pull out, and he wouldn't let me. So essentially what happened is I had to fill an hour by myself. And if it had been my choice to write an hour, I don't think I would have... put myself forward for that. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd have gone, yeah, I could do an hour. In fact, the opposite. I didn't think I could do an hour.
What sort of sets were you doing at the time? Were you doing fives and tens?
I think I was probably doing about, 15s, maybe 10s, 15s.
Okay.
But I'd come from a theatre background where I'd written stuff. I'd written plays, dark comedies, and it was always comedy, but it was always sort of like dark and stuff like that. And then, I'd written a play. It took me a long time to write a play, and it did very badly in Edinburgh. Okay. And then the next year, I'd spent something like 7 years writing it, and no one came to see it, and it got bad reviews. It got one star in The Scotsman, and then they phoned the next day, and they said, actually, it was a printing error. It should have been two. And what people don't realise about Edinburgh is a one star is better than a two star.
Because
two stars means that it's not worth seeing. One star means this is so spectacularly awful. And we sold out the next day. It was brilliant. As soon as that one star review came out, we did really well. And we were coming out. It was a two-hander. It was a duel with Rob, who used to play guitar for me. And it was a two-hander. And we came out at the beginning and people were... Like, every time we opened our mouth, it wasn't written like this. It wasn't written to be, like, particularly punny or anything. It wasn't written to be punny at all. But we came out, and every time we opened our mouth, there'd be someone in the audience going, oh, like it was the most kind of like... And you're like, that's because you've read a one-star review. That's not because you... And by the end of it, we got a standing ovation. And
like a real standing ovation.
Yeah, we won them over by the end of it because I think people were like, oh, it's not that bad. And then by one... I mean, I'm not an idiot. I haven't spent 7 years writing a piece of shit. There was this woman that came to see us who'd reviewed me through three or four... The first year she reviewed... Oh, fucking right. Claire Smith, right?
Here we go.
She reviewed this fucking show I wrote called Christmas Tree in 2002, and her major complaint about it was that it wasn't a musical, right? We never said it was a musical, right? She was from the musical section of the Scotsman. She came to review it, and she didn't like it. And it was just like, well, fine. Then she consistently reviewed us for like the next few years, and it's just like, why are you coming? You know you hate us. You know you don't like us. Why are you coming? So then she gave us this 1-star review, and then we had one of the best audiences we'd ever had the next day after that. It started off as a real struggle, and then it ended in the thing. Anyway, point is, there was like songs and poetry in this little show that we wrote. That sounded really... There's songs and poetry in this little show that we wrote. but I said it. And so the next year, I thought, fuck it, I'm not going to spend 7 years writing a play again. What I'll do is I will enjoy my life, and then I gave myself something like 4 weeks to... I booked the space in, and I gave myself 4 weeks to write a poetry and music show, and we could only afford a 45-minute slot at the Bedlam Theatre in Edinburgh. And so we did it, and it was called A Third of the Way Done, because at the time I was 25, and the average life expectancy is 75. So it was nice and jolly. And and it was all about coming to terms with growing up. And that was literally, there was no story, it wasn't anything like that. It was like me and Rob would sit on stage, we'd both play guitar, and we'd take it in turns doing poems and monologues and songs. And it was that, and it was all around a theme of growing up. And we did that. And it was what it was. It wasn't the most amazing thing ever, but there were some bits in that that I thought were really, really great. For instance, I did a poem. I did some bleps for Channel 4, mm-hmm. And one of them was a poem about growing old together, mm-hmm. and then at the end it goes, "Oh, we could just leave it," or something.
Yeah,
and I wrote that for that show.
Okay,
and so there was kind of a lot that came out of that show in 2007. And then when I had to do a poetry show in 2009, because these other comedians stitched me up, then I literally went through all my back catalogue and found bits and pieces, and I kind of like stitched together an hour of material, and I went on and I did it. And then I had a guest every day, so Joel Domick. I gave them three things to do. They had to find a mug in a charity shop, because I was on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, about then, 3:30, and so like tea time. So and basically my whole approach to it back then was, I'm going to do an anti-whimsy show. I'm going to do like a Josie Long show by someone that's got no ability to do it.
Okay. Right?
That hasn't got enough emotional sensibilities to do it, right? So for instance, Joel was probably the best guest I had, because it was just spectacular. If you don't know who Joel Domit is, he's like this American high school good looking.
He's got an unbelievable jawline.
He is such a bohunk. And he's the nicest guy in the world. Yeah. And just, I love him, right? I love him. But it's great being on stage with him, because he has got the opposite personality on stage to as me, right? So he can come on and he can do like 5 minutes of material, and I can come on after him and go, "Is that really your best material, Joel?" and completely deflate him. And it was funny. Anyway, so Joel would come along, and my thing was that you had to bring a mug that I could make some tea in, you had to do a party piece, and you had to do a poem. And the poem could be anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Joel came on with a mug, and he talked about the mug, and then an audience member had to decide whether they wanted the mug made in the mug that I had or the mug that my guest had provided. And then Joel would sit down, and I'd do another like 15 minutes. Then they'd come on and do their party piece, and then they'd sit down, and then they'd come and do a poem. And so Joel had this lovely poem that his mum wrote for him. I think that was the second time. He did it twice. The first time, Joel's party piece was lactating out of his nipples.
I'm so glad that's recorded for posterity.
He did it with this massive grin on his face, and he couldn't understand why everyone was horrified by it. He was just like, he did it from a really sweet place, and it was amazing. It was just like, it didn't, and I was like, I'm pretty sure that ain't milk, Joel. And it was absolutely the most grimmest thing I've ever seen. Yeah, what a wonderful memory. Thank you. Thank you, Stuart. That was that thing. And when I wrote that show, that was, I think, 100% autobiographical. That was how I felt about things, and that was kind of exactly you know, where I was at that point in my life. And then when I had to follow it up with Keep Hold of the Gold and do a straight hour without guests, without anything, then that was actually quite a big struggle. But that was kind of like the show that people came to see me for. That's the show that...
That was the breakaway show, wasn't it? Jimmy Carr came to see it and tweeted something.
And it had Eddie Mitch look fat in it and stuff like that. And, Bad Things Happen in Trees was a mistake. And I didn't intend to do it, but I made the best out of a bad situation. Keep Hold of the Gold was taking that and distilling it and going, okay, if we're going to do an hour from scratch, how do we do that?
Nick is just one of those people in a small group with Tim Key and James Acaster, probably, and a few others, who, when I see him, he just kind of makes me want to give up. Do you know what I mean? You know, like, it's that simultaneously, God, look what this is. Look what's capable in stand-up. And look what I didn't think to do, you know? He just does something so uniquely himself, I think. So tender and so bruising at the same time. And obviously very, very funny throughout. Really theatrical. And that's what we're talking about here. He's clearly very articulate about that process and his reasons for engaging with it in that way. So thanks to Nick. I hope you're enjoying this episode. I had a great time at the festival last Sunday with Nick's show and then with my own preview at Bob Slayer's Heroes of Fringe. So thanks to Bob as well. And thanks to you if you came along to one of those. And hello as well to Leanne and also to Alex Hilton, who was kind enough to... They were both kind enough to come along. Great to meet you, Alex. No video of this episode, sadly. But remember, you can watch video highlights of the previous 5 episodes with Tony Law, Bo Burnham, Norman Lovett, Susan Kalman and Marcus Brigstock. They're all at youtube.com/comcompod. And a little bit of advertising before we go back to Nick. A week on Sunday, that's the 2nd of March, if you're near Wolverhampton, you can come and see a live special Comedian's Comedian with... I paused there because I was going to say Comcom, and I just think it's a bit lazy. You can come and see a live special Comedian's Comedian with... I'm so pleased to finally get him on the show. Gary Delaney is going to be doing a set and then talking to me afterwards. So I've got lots of things to ask Gary. He's got a lot to say about comedy. That's going to be brilliant. If you're anywhere in the Midlands, come down to the Arena Theatre in Wolverhampton. You can get tickets from the Arena Theatre website. That is the 2nd of March. And if you're on Leamington the following day, if you're in Leamington on the following day, on the 3rd of March, you can come down to LAMP, which is the Leamington Arts and Music Project, and see me do a preview with James Acaster. We're doing an hour each, and I'm going to insist on going first, because I've seen his new hour, and I don't want to follow it. Tickets for that are available from Reckless Comedy. Have a Google of that. I don't have time to look at the blurb. And as a blurb, I've just used blurb to mean... website. But you can find it. As ever, if you're enjoying the show, you can donate using the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. A million thank yous to those people who've been doing that and who continue to do that. It means the world to me. Thank you very much. Now let's get stuck straight back in. This is Nick Helm.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
And were those things, were the things you, like, he makes you look fat, for example, which is, for those who don't know, is a sort of kind of a love song, an attempt to woo someone by pointing out that their boyfriend is so perfect, they're too perfect for them.
Yeah, so basically it's a love song about undermining the person you fancy in order to break them and get them to go out with you.
Yeah, so
which in
that...
a way is the most romantic of all songs.
But so when the fact that that was in that show, does that mean that at the time you were lusting after someone who had too perfect a boyfriend? Was it, you know what I mean? Is it mirroring your actual experience at the time, or is that, did that mirror something that maybe happened to you 10 years ago when you were a kid, or was it just completely created because you thought it, because you thought it was funny?
He Makes It Fat came out with a title first. And I was writing a musical, which I never got around to finishing, called Bloklahoma. For those at home, my face is quite deadpan now. It was called Bloklahoma, and it was all about like the seven stages of masculinity, and it was basically taking musicals and using the structure of The Wizard of Oz, where a man is dumped by a girl for not being manly enough, and then he goes through the land,
okay, yeah,
meeting other men, and they go on a quest to find out who's the manliest man of all. It's better than it sounds. And He Makes It Fat was the title for a song there, and then I had this title in my head, and then I had a preview, funnily enough, in Leicester.
Yeah.
And I think the preview was on Sunday, which was Valentine's Day, so it's literally, this is the 16th of February, isn't it? So this is literally what... 4 years today or 5 years today? Right, yeah.
The gap that people at home can't hear because the gentleman isn't mic'd, is that from someone saying 4 years ago because you were here?
I think it was... Are you sure it was 4 years ago or 5 years ago?
In the Belmont.
Yeah, it's either 4 or 5 years ago. Five Festival 4 years, right. So what happened was on like the Friday or the Saturday, I was in great need of material, and I'd done Bad Things Happening Trees at Leicester before, and that had gone well. And so this year I had to come up with a fucking show, and I didn't have one. And that's what's great about the Leicester Festival, in terms of, not just, I know this isn't for Leicester, but in terms of getting ready for Edinburgh, Leicester is the festival that you book yourself into, because it kicks you in the ass to write something. So in a way, you're all being used.
No more so than any other audience, arguably.
But it's great. So anyway, so I had to write a fuckload of material for the Sunday, and... So I had this title, He Makes You Look Fat, and I stood in front of a music stand with a piece of paper there, and I literally improvised the song, and it came out in about 5 minutes. I think it's a 2.5 minute song, and I did it. I wrote it all out in 5 minutes, and I had too much, and then I structured it, and I came to Leicester on a Sunday with this new song that I thought was going to be amazing, called He Makes You Look Fat. Actually, I never think any of my material is going to be amazing, so I didn't think it was going to be amazing, but I thought, you know, let's give it a go. And we did it, and there was, it was at the Belmont Hotel, right? And there was 9 people in the audience, and the real mixture of people, there were like men and women and different ages and stuff, but 9. And there was a couple, weren't there? There was a Brazilian woman. She was Brazilian?
Argentinian.
For the benefit of the podcast, we've got Nick's memory personified in the audience.
Rob from Leicester is
Rob from Leicester,
who's
Nick's
been
database.
One of my most supportive fans for the last 10 minutes since 4 or 5 years ago. So there was this Argentinian woman in the front row, and she was, you know, gorgeous, and she was with her boyfriend. They looked like a very happy couple, and it was the first time I'd ever performed this song, He Makes You Look Fat, and I hadn't worked out how to do it. You know, the point of what I do is, no matter how much I shout and no matter how angry I am and no matter how much I'm like railing against people, the point at the end of the show is that it should be cathartic and you should come out feeling better than you were in the first place. So I don't want anyone to leave like upset by what has happened. You should all be leaving on like a high, like life. I don't see the point in celebrating life by going, isn't life all fucking, you know, candy floss and roses and all of that? You go, isn't it hard? But at the end of it, either A, at least you're not that guy on stage, or B, fuck it, I've been through that, and do you know what? I can laugh about it, you know? And there's a positive side to it where you can take something that's actually negative. And this is, I suffered from huge depression when I was at university, and you can, I at the time I just used to think, you can either let it consume you and you can lose a couple of years of your life, or you can actually sit down and you can get something positive out of it. So I used to just write down all of my feelings and how I felt about it and make comedy out of that. And now I feel a lot better about life and I can't write. I'm writing material about Eminem's world. What the fuck is that about? But the happier you get, the less you've got a fucking say about it. It's a double-edged sword, you know what? Let's reward that person for making us see life in a new way. Thank you, Nick Helm. You're amazing. And by all of your fucking compliments, you've made me... No, but that's what happens. We're joking here. But are we?
I want to talk to you about...
So I just need to finish this Make You Look Fat thing, because there was this absolutely amazing Argentinian woman and her boyfriend. And so I was singing this song, but I had to read it off a piece of paper because I'd just written it. And I was singing the song going, oh, I've seen your new boyfriend, he's really good looking. And everyone's laughing, right? There were 9 people, but they were all laughing. And Rob was next to me and he was playing the guitar and I was just singing off this piece of paper going, yeah, if he was a rent boy, he merely makes you look fat. And I didn't know at that stage that I shouldn't deliver it to people specifically. Especially not people whose first language isn't English, right? So I did this, I kind of directed the song, right? And at the corner of my eye, I'm going, oh yeah, she is bloody loving this. Her shoulders are jiggling, and she's got a face in her hand. She's bloody loving it, right? So I can see this at the corner of my eye. And then I finished the song, gets like a smattering of applause, and went, look, because there's only 9 people, not because it isn't excellent. And and I look up, and there's this woman, and she's got mascara all down her face on Valentine's Day. In front of her boyfriend in an underpopulated comedy gig, right? Where I've come out and she thinks that I've just called her fat for the last 3 minutes, right? And it's just like, why would I do that? Why would I? And I was much less shouty back then. I was much more, sensitive. And so I think I did it like, I had 20 minutes left of the show and I spent the last 20 minutes apologising to her. And that didn't help though, did it? It didn't help. Giving her Jaffa cakes is the worst thing. Like, you're not fat, love. In fact, come on, let's feed you up. That's fucking... It was literally the worst thing. It was the worst thing that's ever happened. Just like, no, that's the opposite. That's the opposite of what I wanted. To make, 15% of your entire audience cry out of being horrific. On Valentine's Day, oh, fuck me, that was awful. So I almost dropped that song and never did it ever again. And then someone said, actually, that you should do it again. So I did it again. And then that's the one thing that anyone really knows me for, if at all.
Do you think that song...
I hate that song.
Really? That song in particular? I didn't realise that's... Is that more popular than your other songs?
That song is the... That's the song that I did on Russell Howard's Good News that everyone liked. And that's the one that people cut out and said, oh, yeah, that's a good song. And that's the song that people say, yeah, we don't... I'm not sure about your other songs, but that's the song we like. And everything else I kind of sweated over, and that's the one that took 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's... but I don't really hate it. I like everything that I've... You know, I like the fact... If people like it, then I'm really proud of that. And if that's the only thing, then great.
Just going back to what you were saying before about... Well, 2 things, really. It seems like to end up with... to end up being Nick Helm, like a good way to create Nick Helm would be to have someone with loads of theatrical... dreams and hopes and who wanted to make a piece of theatre, and for them to go to the Edinburgh Festival and be kicked and savaged by a critic over and over again. That seems like do you see where I'm going with this? I kind of feel
yeah,
like,
yeah.
like because of what you are on stage now, where you're for want of a better word, clown. Your persona, the game you're playing is you're not giving me enough, you cunts. Like, that's your thing, isn't it?
But that is actually, I mean, I used to do that in Edinburgh when I was, you know, you'd go up with your hour or whatever, or with your show. I mean, all the other thing is, as a club comedian, I try and make whatever club sets that I do as theatrical as possible with, like, an emotional storyline and with kind of like, oh, my God, and there's, like, highs and lows and it starts off as one thing and halfway through is a breakdown and then at the end everyone's singing and then it's like, how are you going to fucking follow that? We better make him a headliner. And that's kind of like how that happened. And then with...
Is it really? Was there an element of that, like, so that you could be a headliner? Or was it purely out of a theatrical creative thing?
It wasn't cynical like that. It was really just, I can't... I think it comes from, like, trying to distract people, you know, from your inabilities. You always, like, do what... I always play to my strengths rather than my weaknesses. So I'm not a great anecdotal comedian. I believe that started back in the day, and I'm not a great so I look at someone like James Acaster and I go, well, I can't do that, so I think, well, how can I still be legitimate? And so in the end, you just, instead of looking around you what everyone else does, you look to yourself and you go, well, what can I actually do?
So, in terms of the starting points for you, that period of depression where you were writing down your feelings, that was one of the things that then, when you had to fill an hour, you had all those pieces of writing.
I've always written. I mean, I've written from, like, so now it's kind of like, I mean, you do get to a stage where it is difficult to write things, and it is difficult to have, like, I think. Over the last 3 years, certainly. So I did Keep Hold of the Gold, and then Dead's Dream was slightly scary. It was a really scary show. And then I did a show called This Means War, which was just carnage in bad and good ways. And then I did One Man Megamyth this year, which is all about the arrogance and all of that. But certainly since Keep Hold of the Gold, what I do on stage has turned into almost like, volume control. Where I think that my favourite show was Bad Things Happen in Trees, and now that I'm kind of writing a series for telly, I'm very aware of how I want to present myself.
Okay.
And it's not... I get asked a lot, you know, in interviews and stuff, you know, oh, you're very shouty and aggressive, or you're a bit of a bully. And that was never what I set out to do. And I don't think that's really a fair description of what I do either, but I'm very aware at this moment that I'm going through a stage where I'm looking at everything that I've written and trying to get back to kind of a balance where it's not just all shouting, it's not just all at 11, it's kind of like a mixture of everything, because that's what it essentially started off as. It was kind of like, it was all about emotions, and whereas I'm not an observational comedian, I'm not an anecdotal comedian, but what I can do is I can kind of describe emotions and how we feel. And when I'm angry on stage, that's because I'm trying to kind of like demonstrate how we're all angry. This is pretentious, isn't it? And then
keep going.
But when I'm angry on stage, I'm trying to demonstrate how we all get angry. And then for people in the audience, it's cathartic. And then for when I'm happy, it's like joyous, and everyone else is, you know. And you're kind of trying to kind of like represent how everyone feels. And if I am a bully, I like to think I'm a bully to the bullies, right? I'm not. I'm standing up for people in the audience who, if someone's talking through my show, then I'll do it because I think it's funny, and really they shouldn't be talking, and it's a waste of everyone's money around them, and people have got babysitters in, and so I'm sticking up for my audience by doing that. I'm not picking on my audience, and if there's people that, every year it's kind of like sometimes I'll make a friend in the audience, and sometimes I'll find an enemy in the audience, and sometimes I'll find, you know, a lover in the audience or whatever, but there'll be kind of different aspects on that.
I was
but I feel like I've kind of, what happens is the more busy you get, I was going to say successful, but I mean the more busy you get in the year, the less time you have to devote to writing your Edinburgh hour. I've always done Edinburgh, and I'd like to think that I've done Edinburgh since school plays in 97. So I've done it for fucking ages. And I was meant to have a year off this year, and I'm doing it this year. I'm not doing the full run, but I couldn't not do
You're
it.
You're going to do an Edinburgh run as well as write a series?
Well, because I reckon that the series comes out in autumn, so it'll be like the best bits from the series that I can... But it'll be on the free fringe, and it'll be more of a fuck around like I did in 2009 than... When you have people saying, right, you're in a 250-seater venue, you've got this amount of money behind you. I put all of my own money into my shows as well. I mean, so people were like saying, oh, this is what Nick Hamlet's like on a budget. It's just like, well, no. I was told last year when I did One Man Megamyth that I was in the biggest venue I've ever played in Edinburgh, but I wasn't allowed a band. And I tend to use the band to kind of fill the stage up. So then I was in a position where I've got to do the smallest show I've ever done in the biggest room I've ever done with people that have just started to get to know me off of doing huge spectacles. So, not glasses, but like... good. So you're kind of painted... I felt like I was sort of painted into a corner. So, and also, I had less time to write it than any other year. I think I had something stupid like 3 months to write it, and I would normally take... I'd normally start work January. I'd think of it over Christmas and then work in January and work constantly up till August for something that I can't tour because it's too big and it involves David Trent, and he is the most sought-after act... in England. So you've got to kind of, as soon as you start introducing the band members, you've got to juggle other people's time. So I can't really tour my shows. So I had to spend 2.5 to 3 months writing One Man Megamyth. And it was just, so when you've got a short amount of time, you go, well, what works? Well, what works is opening big, closing big, having a breakdown in the middle, and this kind of, and then you end up like, what was good about it originally was that it wasn't a formula, and then you end up realising that you've got... This is more of a breakdown than what I do on stage. I'm literally unravelling. You know, I'm giving
Mish,
away...
I owe you a pound.
I'm giving away everything. I think that...
Well, I was going to ask about that, about the just on the subject of the formula, and I don't know if formula is the right word, but it because you're doing that cathartic journey, which seems to be born of your intentions and your origins as a playwright, that you want to be writing something that is a whole spectacle in itself, but it has an element of catharsis, and it feels like a play.
It's like a full on show, isn't it? And kind of like you're making people experience something. Like when I did Dare to Dream, there was a guy that came out to me and he said, "Oh God, that was like the Saw ride at Thorpe Park, right?" And you go, well, yeah, I know. And what I could have done was just done like an hour of stand-up, and that would have been fine as well. But what we did was did something different, and that's kind of...
Yeah. You know, do you think that there is a longevity to the formula? Do you start to feel now? It sounds like, I mean, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that you can keep recreating that journey because it's so archetypal, because it's so kind of birth, death, resurrection?
No, I don't think. I get criticism saying that, oh well, it's kind of similar to what he did before or whatever, which would imply that there isn't much longevity to it. But the thing is, you know, if you look at Jimmy Carr, he's got, who I like, but he's got like 17 DVDs that are all the same format of him coming out and doing jokes. So the thing is, nobody questions if you're telling jokes. Oh, that's kind of similar to last year's because the material was different. But what I get is it's just like, well, it's kind of similar to last year in the sense that you came in and I took you from one place to another. Mm-hmm. But every single joke in there and every single song and every single poem and every single concept in there is a completely different thing.
Sure. But if you are telling a story throughout it, is that not the downside of, like, there's a lift. If you're telling a story, that gives you certain huge benefits in terms of an hour. But then maybe you need to tell a different story. You know, you need to tell something that is...
Yeah, and it's all about finding what that relationship is that year. Like this year, you know, I have a reputation for doing like audience participation, and this year I didn't really want to do much audience participation because I didn't really, you know, have a great idea for it, or I felt like I've done that and I don't want to be that guy. But so I kind of like gave it a bit of lip service, and I brought some people on and then took them straight off again, and I kind of like, well, that was that bit, now let's get on with the new stuff. But I think there is a thing. Well, here's the thing. Because I am relatively unknown on the grand scheme of things, I think what the position that you're put into is that I did Keep Hold of the Golden, that room of people really liked it, and then when I did Dare to Dream, you've sort of got to introduce people to what you do whilst at the same time moving it on for the people that have come back. So you're kind of like trying to make two groups of people happy, your old fans and your new fans. Mm-hmm. And then in between Dare to Dream and This Means War, I did Live at the Electric, and we got a lot of people to come and see us based off Live at the Electric. So in that time you go, well, I had a band on Live at the Electric, so I've got to have a band on stage because that's what they're coming to see me for. And at the same time, they've never heard of me, and I've got to reintroduce them to what I do and still create a new show for the people that are coming to see me based on Keep Up.
Sure.
And then with this year, it's just like, right, well, I've still got to do the same thing again, but hopefully there'll be a stage when you can just kind of take the whole audience with you each time you go on stage, as opposed to having to start at the ground floor with some people and kind of, you know, it's a balancing act.
It's interesting. I wonder if it's almost a bit paradoxical that for someone who on stage appears to just, and part of what we as an audience celebrate is the fact that you don't give a fuck. You're smashing, you know, boundaries all over the place, clambering amongst us, sweating, often getting people on stage. And what we're loving is the fact that there are no rules and there's no sense of control or responsibility, that actually you as the performer feels an enormous amount of responsibility to give us that very thing.
Yeah. Well, it's not an accident, is it? I mean, it's not like... Yeah, you do a gig like today. No, we were all in this gig today, and that's and you've got people talking at the back. And I don't mind if people are talking. I don't mind if people go for a wee or anything like that. But it seems like at this stage, when you're in the preview stage, it would be a complete waste of an opportunity to not have a go at them, because you never know what gold might come out of it.
Yeah,
and not just the gold that comes out in the toilets, am I right, guys? you never know what gold might come out of it, because I write on stage. I'll have like notes, like Eminem's World, and I'll see where that goes. And if it doesn't go anywhere, I'll drop it. But if it goes somewhere and it builds and builds and builds, then...
But presumably with the Eminem's World bit, and I don't want to sort of give too much away, but given that we...
Yeah, you don't want to give anything away on that one, Stu.
Yeah. Well, it has a proper punchline at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you... But you have that... When you say you write on stage, you're bringing the like the bare bones of the
joke. That's a true story.
Yeah, sure.
So all you're doing is you're like trying to explain the story. I mean, that happened... Me and James Acaster in Eminem's World, and that all happened. And then... Yeah, what the fuck are you talking about, mate? A specialist tour.
Sure.
But like, but that happened to both of us, you know, at the same time.
Yeah.
And then I said the thing, and then you say to James, are you going to do that, or am I going to do that? That's always the thing with James, isn't it?
Course.
And he goes, I'm not going to do it. And, like, going, and I go, brilliant. But I didn't realise what James meant by that. And that was, that's such a rubbish anecdote, Nick. it's good enough for Leicester, though, so let's see.
But you come on with the anecdote, and then what you're, that process of mining, let's just focus on that. When you're writing on stage, you've got...
I'll tell you what a better example would be the cocksucker material.
Yeah.
Where I wrote that as... I mean, you know, you try and make it look like it's spontaneous, but in actual fact, that you've tried it out, and then you build it and build it and build it and build it until eventually it's a thing with a punchline. And then it goes, oh, but when you start, you don't have that punchline. You say that punchline once by accident, you know. Especially with something that's so fragile as kind of listing other comedians. And it's just kind of like you don't want to be, you know, shooting yourself in the foot by kind of like insulting people that you actually work with. Because I think I think it's all done in character, you know, where literally I am saying that, you know, cocksucking is the equivalent of performing and giving everything that you've got to your audience, and as a result, that gives me free rein to call every single comedian I know a cocksucker, and then say that I'm the best out of all of the cocksuckers. And that's kind of like, you're taking the piss, aren't you? You're self-grandising.
Sure.
I mean,
and in terms of what...
Jokes never work when you explain them, but, you know... And to be fair, everyone got the joke, but it's...
Yeah.
But that's a good example of a thing where you write on stage.
So which bit of that did you bring on stage? Or did you just one time you were calling people cocksuckers and you went, hang on a minute, there's a way to do this legitimately?
Yeah, just the comparison. Do you know what? I mean, it's just like... Oh, man. People take me for granted. Right, I started a show last year where I came out saying I got the whole audience to chant Nick Helm is fucking amazing whilst jumping on a mini trampoline. And then by the end of it, I told the whole audience to fuck themselves. Standing ovations. got nominated for an award. Nobody goes out and does that. And then yet they say, yeah, it's a bit similar to last year, is it? Fuck you fucking pricks. Fucking take me for fucking granted. I won't be doing this 1 year, you know. I'll be dead 1 year. And you'll be going, where's Nick Helm, eh? With his bag of fun. With his little bag of tricks. Fucking, no, yeah. But, yeah, so I don't know. You just try and do stuff and see what works and what doesn't.
What sort of decisions are you making on stage then? When you're in the moment and you are improvising something... What, like, are you out of control completely? Are you trying to just put anything out there and see if it's, is it like you're kind of, you know, roughing the paint all over the canvas to see what emerges, or what's the experience of doing it?
Well, I'm quite a moral person, and I've got kind of like quite a strict, you know, guideline of what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not comfortable with. So you could say I'm out of control, but it's always within those kind of moral guidelines of what I will and won't do, and what I will and won't make fun of and make jokes about and stuff like that. I don't think, in the grand scheme of things, I'm actually particularly controversial. People seem to think that I'm controversial, but I think that's because they've misunderstood what I do. I don't see shouting and swearing as controversial. I don't see swearing as controversial. I don't see anything like that as controversial. And it's all about the context at the end of the day anyway. But yeah, I'm not a controversial comedian, so I just think you come out and you try stuff. Also, it's a comedy thing. You know, even the people that were talking at the back when I was having a go at them knew that I was joking.
Sure.
It's a bit, you know.
But
what if I wasn't joking? The fact is, they were in the wrong. Mm-hmm. They were talking. All I was doing was pointing that out and having a go at them. But sure. I did it in a way that made everyone feel part of the fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
As opposed to a way that made everyone feel slightly awkward that I'd kind of got up my own arse.
I suppose what I'm asking is, like, you've obviously, during your career, you have found a thing, which is a moment ago you said, someone got up to go for a piss. Of course I'm going to jump on that because some gold might come out of that. So that process of looking for... all right. So, but that process of knowing that if you get in a confrontation with someone, then stuff... I mean, that is incredible. That is incredible timing.
Biggest fan. He does that once an hour, you know.
You must, what I'm trying to unpack is the instincts that you're following when you, like, you know, for example, that if you have a go at someone, chances are that will trip something that will then come out of you. You'll be more creative because of it, or because you're being more provocative because of it. What is that?
I find material, especially my material, quite boring. And you never know what, you know. Brilliant. We can do this stuff that I have written down, that I've got a pretty good idea that might work and all of that. Or we can do something that's actually in the moment and kind of exciting for me. Also, the more you mess yourself up, the harder it is to get back to your show and your material and to tie things up and to kind of leave the stage so that everyone feels like they've had something satisfying. And that doesn't always work, sorry. But sometimes it does work, and sometimes you go, oh, wow, and you've got to try.
And because
that.
The leap has been further, because by smashing up, by making it, by giving yourself less chance of somehow pulling it all back together, when you do, it's more satisfying. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think so. But also, as it's work in progress, you kind of... you know, there's a certain amount of, I don't know. I mean, I just do things that I think are funny, really. And I feel, yeah, that if people find it funny, then that's great. And if they don't find it funny, I don't do it again. But what is the most satisfying thing in the world is to go up to someone in the front row and call them a cunt. And then have them come up to you afterwards and shake you by the hand and say thank you. and the thing is, people say, oh, whoa, that's... But, I mean, that's clearly trial and error, yeah? You don't just... you don't suddenly think, I know what's a good idea, and then do it, right? You kind of, like, ease your water. You ease your foot in the water, don't you? You kind of, like, go, all right, you're Wally. Got away with that one.
And then, is that where that came from? Did you launch into calling people cunts? What was the first confrontation like that you remembered?
I'll tell you where that comes from. That actually comes from Edinburgh and doing gigs in front of. I remember we did a gig. It was the year Angelos first did Shooting Stars, and Shooting Stars was being broadcast on TV. I think, or it was close to being broadcast on TV, just as Angelos. So nobody in Edinburgh knew who Angelos was, but at the same time, he was huge on telly. Like, he was doing this, is it BBC Two? And he was just this massive thing. And I did a gig with him. There was about four other acts, and we were there, and it was a rainy day in Edinburgh, like in the mid-afternoon. And literally, one by one, we all went up on stage and died in front of nine people or eight people or whatever. Not all of my gigs in front of nine people. But I looked to you to confirm it, but this was a different gig. But this is, you know, there was a really low number of people that were in the room. And you go, oh, God. And, like, and nobody, none of the acts wanted to be there. None of the audience wanted to be there. They weren't enjoying it. Everyone was just in there to get out of the rain, you know. And in one by one, we were going up, and it could have been a really nice gig, and it was just rubbish. And then by the time it got to me, I was so frustrated with how it was going. I was just like, "Why are you here?" You know. But I was screaming it. I'm just like going, "Why are you here? You know, what a waste of your time. What a waste of our time. You know, why don't we just call it quits and just fucking leave, right? Why don't we just fucking go to the bar, have a drink? We'd all have a much better time where we can chat, right, to each other. Not each other, but you could talk to your friends and we can just fuck off and do something better with our lives, you know? Right?" And then the audience didn't really laugh, but the acts laughed. And then it was kind of like, it kind of saved the gig for us morally, you know, for us in our hearts. It was just kind of like, oh, you know what, it was a good idea to do this with our lives, you know, this wasn't a huge mistake. And we kind of like, and then Angelos went on dressed up in a cat suit where you could see his penis and balls through this shiny kind of like, but he did this song, like, dressed up as a cat to nothing, right? And it went on for like 15 minutes and the audience gave him nothing. And I think that is what really summed up Edinburgh for me, like, at that point, was just kind of like, this is like, you just look at that and you go, that is clearly funny, right? That's clearly just funny. And the fact that nobody is laughing at it, for me, makes that even funnier. I think that is just one of the best things, you know? It was great. And so from that, it was just kind of like, there's a lot of apathy in Edinburgh. And then you go, right, well, let's just fucking, you know, as much as you want to think that Edinburgh's, not you, but like, as much as one wants to think that Edinburgh is kind of like their moment to shine, in reality, the people are going to see nine shows a day. They're fucking dead on their feet. They sit down and they fall asleep in your show. And then they go off and see something else. And at the end of the month, they can say, I saw 97 shows. Right? But, it's, you know, people aren't there because you're special. People are there because it's something to do. And what I try and do is just wake people up so that at least they're paying attention.
So given that's definitely an idiom of yours, is that you come on, bang, shouting, waking them up, and kind of like just sort of, you know, rolling them, you know.
That, but also, you know, there's songs, there's poetry, there's one-liners,
absolutely,
there's stories, there's audience participation, there's props, there's stunts, there's costumes, there's set, there's all these, there's a band sometimes, there's all this visual stuff, and it's kind of like going like, you change what you do every 5 minutes because that means that the audience are kind of like, they can't second guess it. They're like going, oh, you know, that's what you do. and so that's kind of, that's where the thinking is. And it's also kind of like, if you didn't like that bit, don't worry, there's another bit coming along. And, you know.
With a view to doing Heavy Entertainment, which is your new solo TV show.
Yeah.
Not as opposed to Uncle, in which you're a comic actor, but it's written by someone else.
I'm a puppet.
I don't think we've got time to cover Uncle as well. But what I wanted to ask was, with your show that you're writing, do you have any concerns about the fact that, like, does it need to be set like TV is? If you think of someone like Terry Alderton, it's much harder for Terry Alderton to get a spot on a TV show because he's really wild and random. You're very wild and upsetting, and you break into stuff and clamber over people. Do you have concerns about how that will translate to television?
Yeah, that's what the hardest thing about it is, because we did the pilot when we did the. I don't know if anyone, I don't know how many people saw it, but it wasn't loads. But we did. Thanks, Rob. but when we did the pilot of Heavy Entertainment, they told me end of January. Do you want to do a series of Heavy Entertainment? And I said, I'd just done first series of Live at the Electric and I hadn't enjoyed it because we were on last and the audiences left for the tube when we were on stage doing it. And you're watching the audiences like flooding out and you're going, literally your dreams are dying in your eyes. And you're going, there's a fucking camera on me. Smile. And so Live at the Electric, I found quite, and I didn't really enjoy the kind of experience of doing like live TV. Not live TV, but TV in front of a live audience. So when they said, do you want to do like a thing in front of an audience? I said, no. And then they said, well, you've got 5 weeks to do it because it's got to be made and edited by the end of the tax year.
That's showbiz.
That's showbiz. So I thought, right, well, I can either go 5 weeks or I can go 5 weeks. And I thought, well, 5 weeks isn't so long to do a project that I don't really want, you know, hadn't really made my mind up with. It's not going to take the rest of my life. It'll take 5 weeks, and then it'll be over, and then I'll write Edinburgh. And so we did that, and it was kind of interesting, but I didn't 100% love the last product of it. I kind of found that difficult. I think the problem with it is that the problem that I have with it is that it's what I do is all about the audience, and nothing always works. You know, things don't always work, but the fact that I'm saying it is sometimes the joke as opposed to what I'm saying. And it's very difficult to illustrate that when you've got a camera on your face and everything is at face value. You know, it's kind of like, I've said a joke, like my one-liners, they're kind of good, they're kind of bad, sometimes they're shit. But do you know what I mean? It's like,
part of the joke is you've had the temerity to tell a joke.
Part of the joke
is
that I'm saying these are the best jokes you've ever fucking heard, and there's explosions coming after them, and they're just slightly weak cracker jokes, you know? And kind of that's the joke. But when you're saying them directly to a camera, it's face value, and you go, well, this joke is shit. How dare he say that on my telly? It's like, you're not even watching, mate, you're on Twitter, right? And so part of that is like trying to find a way, now that we've learned, I learned so much from doing the pilot, part of it now is like trying to find a way to translate what I do on stage into a television scenario, because that's where it will be made of. It's a massive, it's very stressful. Because in a way, it doesn't have to, you know. My material at best is weak.
That's clearly not the case, though.
Well, I'm very hard on myself, and I
think your performance is so strong. I mean, your performance is incredibly strong. I think your material's really strong as well. So what are you saying? That it feels like if you have your performative legs taken out from underneath you because of the different context?
I think that the performance is such a big part of how I developed the material in the first place. It's not what I say necessarily, it's the way I say it. So, so it's kind of like it's a difficult thing. I can't write it down as a script, you know. And that's one of the things they want me to do. And it's kind of difficult to kind of like work it all out. But I'm working it out, you know. It's kind of, but this is literally new for me. And this isn't something that I've necessarily said, I've got this great idea for a TV show. I'm kind of working backwards where I'm going. I've got this thing. It's like problem solving. But it's the same with Edinburgh. And you go, at first I was doing Edinburgh because I'd love to do it. And then you're kind of like, okay, I've got to do another one. How do I do it?
Sure.
So it's kind of problem solving. But which is what I'm looking forward to Edinburgh this year, because it's kind of...
problem solved.
It's just it's a bit of fun, isn't it? And you get to go out and play with the audience.
We'll have to wrap up fairly soon. If it's all right with you, Nick, I was going to ask if anyone in the audience had any questions for you. Is that...
that's fine.
Are you happy to speak to them?
Yeah.
Have a couple of minutes now to think of a question. I'll ask something else while you have a think. And then if you put your hands up and ask it through me for the sake of the recording. I wanted to ask, what elements... you mentioned one already, that thing that you're not an anecdotalist. Are there any other things that you wanted to do when you started that you feel like you're still striving towards? Given that the things you know that you do, you're so good at... are there things that... do you know what I mean? The poems are great. The shouting is great. The audience stuff is great. The sweating is great. The tasks are funny. Do you know what I mean? There's all of that stuff. Are there things... Do you ever think to yourself, God, I wish I could just do a bit more of that?
No, not really. it's like a perfect storm, though, isn't it? You go, right, all of these bits on their own are kind of like maybe... well, I don't know. I mean, I don't... I just try and just do stuff that I want to do. And when I started doing comedy, it was just like, can I do comedy? It's like, oh, well, I'm all right at it. And then can I make any money off of it? And then you make enough money to get your travel expenses paid. And you go, Mum, guess what? I got my travel paid to Leicester and back. And your mum is proud. And you go, that's great. And then, you know, I didn't think that I would get to this point. I never thought or tried really to get to this level, because I just wanted to do stuff that I thought was good and that I liked. And now I'm at a stage where I've done a sitcom, and I've got another TV series coming up. So I'm not an idiot. It's just like, well, fuck, I might as well just do as much as I can while I can. So that's all I'm doing, really. I'm just kind of like...
Is there any kind of master plan for you? Do you have ambitions? Do you have kind of specific, like, measurable ambitions? Do you want to do the band at Wembley one day? Do you want to, you know?
No, but if an opportunity like that came along, then I would obviously take it and see. I always said that I would never say no to something outright. I never wanted to do panel shows. I went through a long stage where I said I won't do panel shows. And then I did 8 out of 10 Cats, and I really enjoyed it. And I did it, and I was fine. And okay, that's fine. If I'd have said no to that, then I would have cut off a huge point. You know, I always said that I'd never do adverts. And I did, you know, long before, you know, my career took off in any way, but I did an advert because I had to, because I couldn't afford shoes, you know? And then that was just like... but I literally couldn't. I had holes in my shoes. And... like all the rainwater would come in and my feet were burning, and like my feet would like burn because of the acid rain or whatever, because that's London. And I couldn't afford, I had one pair of trousers that I had to wash every time I left the house. Not every time I left the house. I was a massive ejaculator back then. but like I had to, you know, I had one pair of trousers and all of that stuff. I couldn't afford food. I couldn't afford nothing. And then I did an advert, and it got me out of a hole. And then because I wasn't worried about money all the time because of the advert, I could write stuff. And in actual fact, you know, for any comedians that are starting out and that are going, well, Bill Hicks says don't do adverts and all that, fuck that. You know, do what. When you get to a stage when you're Bill Hicks doing an advert, turn it down. But before then, you know, if you can't eat, then you're a fucking dick. There's nothing admirable about dying in the gutter because you want to be an artist, you know, because that just means that people don't get to see what you do. So I think, you know, you just, you know, stick to your guns artistically. But the other thing is, like, John Lydon, he did that butter advert, didn't he? So Johnny Rotten did a butter advert, and everyone was like, "Oh God, you're such a fucking sellout, John. You did a fucking advert." And he goes, "Well, yeah, but A, I like butter, and B, with the money I made off it, I made a new album, mm-hmm. which no one was going to put the money up for." And it's kind of like you just need to. I think the main, if you're going to learn anything from tonight, it's that you just need to think about what you want and not try and follow what other people want, really.
Are there any questions before we wrap up? Yes, there's one down the front. I'll just repeat it down the mic if you don't mind. Whoa, great question. So, Nick, with the success of Uncle on BBC Three, Heavy Entertainment, and Live at the Electric, also on BBC Three, are you worried that you're going to become, and there were air quotes there, a BBC Three comedian? Maybe you could tell us what you think is meant by that.
I know exactly what you mean. But I think that not just BBC Three, but I think that comedy is subjective, right? And I think that, having said that, there is quite a low standard of television comedy across the board. I know what people think of BBC Three, and I, you know, can't say I don't agree a lot of the time. No, I can't. But like, and I think that when I was quite snobby about it, and when I was doing Uncle, and I was thinking, oh, yeah, but it would be nice if it was on BBC Two, you know, rather than. And I think we, me and Oliver, who did it, always kind of like had kind of like. We thought, well, we're in our heads. We were thinking we're making a BBC Two sitcom that's going to be on BBC Three, and it's. Well, we weren't sure how it was going to go down. You know, I was really worried. I think there's things that I've never acted before and all of that. And I didn't know. None of us knew how it was going to go down, really. And it's been really successful, and people have really liked it. And people have said nice things to me, and that's great. And I think now I've kind of changed how I feel about it. And the thing is, BBC Three... Everyone looks down on it. Everyone goes, BBC Three is this awful channel. And the thing is, Uncle's on it. And if we can do a show that's good and kind of like bring people over to BBC Three, then why should we run away from BBC Three as soon as we can? I'm kind of proud to be on BBC Three. And I'm proud to have a good show on BBC Three. And if I'm doing heavy entertainment for BBC Three, I want to make that as good as possible. And I want to kind of, and not like single-handedly, but if... Everyone tries. First and foremost, nobody sets out to make a piece of shit. And you can work just as hard on making something that's awful as you can on making something that's amazing. And it's kind of like not up to you at the end of the day. You know, I'm acting. I've got no control over the rest of it. And you kind of... It could be good, could be bad, but I'd act just as hard in anything that I did. And Oliver would write as much as he could. So it's kind of like not up to you at the end of the day. It's kind of almost fate. And what's good and what's bad is kind of... You know, people didn't set out to make something that's terrible. BBC Three is like almost exclusively comedy. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like it's a comedy channel. You know, that's amazing. And the fact that BBC are doing that's great. So rather than kind of look down on it, you go, how can we improve it? Mm-hmm. And you stick with it, I think, is how I'm thinking about it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Having said that, I will never work for BBC Three again.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for. Would you please join me in thanking Mr. Nick Helm?
So that was Nick, really articulate and passionate and doing it for the love of it and just hilarious. If you're listening in another country, maybe if you've not heard of him or if he's somehow escaped your notice over here, please go and see him if you haven't. See him on tour, check him out on YouTube and indeed on BBC Three. Uncle is very, very good. But also I can't wait for his series. I think it's going to be fascinating to see what he does
and I have every confidence that it is going to be as funny and as exciting as all the rest of his stuff. Thank you to Nick. Thanks to Adnam, who produced the live show. Thanks to Ad's wife, Catherine, for her help, and to Russell the Soundman, to give him his full name. Thanks to Ben Lund-Conlon and Nathan Wood, who co-produced this show. Nick doesn't have any stuff on Audible, as far as I can see, but doing my little Audible plug... Oh, no, well, I mean, he doesn't have stuff on Audible, but you can certainly buy several of his albums on iTunes. So why not do that? Go and Google or YouTube a couple of his songs. If you like them, stop YouTubing them and buy them, because it's consistent quality. So go and do that. But my Audible plug this week, in his stead, I would like to suggest Becoming Johnny Vegas, which is the Johnny Vegas autobiography. I've not actually listened to it yet. It's the first time I'll plug something I've not listened to. But it's 12 motorway deleting hours of someone who I think is awesome. I spoke to Johnny very briefly on Show Me the Funny. Who remembers that? And I had a really good conversation with him, not all of which, very little of which you actually saw on the show. He is a very switched on guy. I'd love to get him on the show. I'm sure that autobiography will be fascinating. So get to that. If you'd like to get that, remember, you get your subscription via audible.co.uk/CC. And that means you can help out this show at the same time. Donate on PayPal if you like. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Nick. We're back next week with the one-man sketch explosion that is Will Franken. I edited that the other day, and it is I didn't edit it. I listened to it. I've done very little. But it's a really, really good one. And I gig with Will at the weekend. Brilliant to see his very esoteric, weird stuff really doing very well in a commercial Saturday night kind of a club. So look forward to that. I'll stop speaking in this sort of absurd high-speed way, and I'll run off and get a train immediately. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.